Hi, this is Alan Chartok here today with Robert Gleason. Robert Gleason has dedicated nearly 30 years to researching the threat of nuclear terrorism and the possibility of nuclear annihilation. He was recently featured in the History Channel special Prophets of Doom. He has also had an extremely long and successful career as an acquisitions editor in New York Publishing. Stephen King, Robert Heinlein, Nancy Friday, Harold Robbins, Father Andrew Greeley, Joy Fielding, Margaret Truman, Jack Anderson, Whitley Strieber, Ed McBain, Ice-T, Reggie Jackson, and former Secretaries of Defense Caspar Weinberger and William Cohen are among the hundreds of notables and best-selling authors that Gleason has signed up and edited. He has worked for Simon & Schuster Pocketbooks, Playboy Press, and for the last 28 years at Forge Books, where he is executive editor. He has published more than a dozen novels on his own and co-authored several, most recently, Apocalypse 2012. In 1995, New York City named a day after Robert Gleason for the work he'd done for prison literacy, which included editing and publishing a sizable number of inmates and ex-offenders, and included speaking in many, many prisons. Robert Gleason was born in Michigan City, Indiana. He has an A.B. in English Literature from Indiana University, a master's degree in English from the University of Wisconsin, and he attended the Sorbonne, all of which were financed by seven hellish years in the Gary steel mills. He has worked in New York book publishing as an acquisitions editor pretty much forever. When he began, he says, he and his colleagues chiseled books on the walls of caves. His latest chiseled book is The Nuclear Terrorist, His Financial Backers and Political Patrons in the U.S. and Abroad. Welcome, Robert Gleason.
Thanks for having me.
Robert, so much that I've just read is of great interest to me, but we're talking about nuclear terrorism today, but I can't help asking one question. What's iced tea really like?
When I told him that, you know, that I'd been in 60 prisons in New York named a day after me for the work I did for prison literacy, this is when we first met. All he heard was 60 prisons. And so we're talking later, some sales guys, and in the middle of out of nowhere, he said to the sales guys, he said, man, he said, I knew a lot of guys that stretched. And he said, but I never knew nobody like this. And here, 60 prisons, man, he's done some time.
Did you like him?
Oh, yeah, I liked Ice a lot. And I like Coco enormously. I'm a legendary tarot card reader, and I've read the tarot for Coco and her mother. Ice will not let me read his tarot cards.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so let's begin on terrorism. To some degree, many of us in this world really are like the ostrich. We want to put our heads in the sand. We really don't want to know certain things. But you make a very compelling case in this book about nuclear terrorism. So is it inevitable that it's going to happen? And if it does happen, how will it happen?
Yeah, well, it is actually inevitable given enough time. The problem is that once you get the nuclear bomb fuel, it's shockingly easy to cobble together a crude but extremely powerful terrorist nuke. The guy that invented the triggering mechanism for the Hiroshima bomb, Luis Alvarez, a Nobel laureate, Alvarez said that if you get a chunk of highly enriched uranium, the size of a large grapefruit bomb grade, and you put one on the floor and you hold one 6 feet above it and you drop it and you hit it square, he said you can get 50% of the Hiroshima yield. He said, to get an old piece of cannon barrel and actually do a version of the Hiroshima bomb, he said a high school boy could do that. He said, it's shockingly easy. Now, the problem is, it's also embarrassingly easy to get the nuclear bomb fuel. That we do at our own nuclear weapons labs where we store it, we do something called mock intrusion tests. And they'll get guys, sometimes ex-special forces, dress them up as maintenance workers, see if they can walk in the main gate, walk out with some nuclear bomb fuel. 50% of the time, they walk out with it. They have to alert the guards that they're doing the test because they don't want the guards shooting one of these guys, you know, so that the guards know they're coming. Still, 50% of the time they walk out. At Rocky Flats, which has thankfully been closed, it was the largest repository.
And that is where?
In Colorado.
Yeah.
And it was the largest repository for nuclear explosive in this country. 80% of the time they walked out the main gate. Once at Los Alamos, they wanted to see how much they could walk out with. So they dragged a flatbedded Home Depot garden cart and piled canisters of nuclear explosive onto it, walked out the main gate in front of God and everybody. Nobody stopped them.
Okay.
We have a semi-rational country. What about countries like Pakistan, Russia, India, countries that live by the backsheesh, where corruption's a way of life? How easy is it there? And also the new threat, which we can get into later if you want, is Japan. They are becoming one of the biggest plutonium producers in the world.
President Obama said recently he doesn't worry nearly as much about what's going on in Ukraine as he does about somebody bringing a bomb into New York. Does he have reason to worry?
Yeah, it's frighteningly feasible. It's too easy to get. Now there's 53 countries that have bomb fuel. There's been studies done. It's poorly secured. Japan now, they have about 40 tons of plutonium. They can't use it. They can't burn it in any of their reactors. However, for 22 years, they've been working on, at a cost of $20 billion, they've been working on a plutonium production plant. It's called Rakosho, and they have no use for it. They're going to be producing 9 tons of plutonium a year. Furthermore, the Japanese culture does not allow them to effectively secure it. The guards are not allowed to carry a sidearm, any guns at all. They don't do serious background checks on them. You could hire Osama bin Laden to guard the bomb fuel there. It's completely insane. The last two administrations have gone crazy trying to talk to them about the security.
To talk to the Japanese.
The Japanese, yeah.
But you've also indicated that while the administrations may be talking to them, that we have our own problems here.
Oh, yeah. There's been serious studies on it. Now, Henry Sulkowski is one of the really smart nuclear proliferation experts, and Edward Lyman say that the stuff is very insecure worldwide, and that the one agency that's supposed to be looking after it, the UN Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, they have huge disappearances of nuclear bomb fuel, and they never know about it. It's essentially impossible for them to monitor it for a lot of reasons. And they try to, and they're supposed to, but they basically can't.
So what is nuclear terrorism, the title of your book?
Well, there's a couple of different kinds. There's some very serious nuclear terrorism going on in Pakistan today, as we speak. There's a group called Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, whose goal is to destabilize the Pakistani government and to install Sharia law. And they're blowing up major army installations. They're also attacking nuclear facilities in Pakistan. There was one called the Wah Cantonment Nuclear Ordnance Plant. And they went in and they killed 59 people, wounded 70. They blew up parts of it, and they blew up themselves. And there's at least 5 others that they blew up that we believe are nuclear plants, that these are bases. You know, this stuff is obviously classified. They have promised in 2012, they said they were going to come to the United States and make major attacks. They did come here, and they tried to create an explosion in Times Square in 2010. I take them at their word. One of the things is I think they're convinced that they can't destabilize the Pakistani government themselves. But if they launch some serious attacks against us, and there's a second group called Laskar-e-Taiba that has done really bad attacks in India, including the famous Mumbai attack. If they got India angry enough, India and the United States, we could destabilize the Islamabad pretty easily. And their goal is to destabilize Islamabad, have an Islamist takeover. And their worst-case scenario is there's so much chaos that during the chaos, they steal some nuclear materials and put together a bomb.
Could you help me with the word destabilize? I'm interested. You keep using it. What does it mean?
Well, the government comes apart. The government can't function. Mm-hmm. And they have, and we've documented over 50 serious terrorist groups in Pakistan. And if the central command all came apart, let's say we nuked Islamabad, something like that, the whole country would you'd have chaos in the country. And, you know, they would like to see some kind of chaos. There's a lot of...
I'm sorry, Bob, why did you say if we nuked? What would make us nuke Pakistan?
Somebody came in and melted down Indian Point. It's real easy to melt down a nuclear power plant. Fukushima taught us that all it takes is you blow up the cooling pumps. Mm-hmm. You don't have to enter the control room. You just know where the cooling pumps are. There was a guy here named Sharif Mobley who worked in 5 or 6 nuclear power plants. He was a close associate of Anwar al-Awlaki. He's in a prison right now in Yemen for killing a law enforcement officer in Yemen. And he was initially arrested as a terrorist, but now they're just trying to get him for the murder. But he has avowed, you know, co-workers talked about, he talked jihad all the time that he was working in these nuclear power plants. He wasn't there because he enjoyed working at nuclear power plants. He was researching it. We do know that one of the secondary targets during 9/11 was a nuclear power plant, probably Indian Point. That they've talked about this for a long time. They found records of it. They went in and they got a bunch of computers in Pakistan, actually, and they found Al-Qaeda records on the computers.
The book we're talking about is The Nuclear Terrorist, His Financial Backers and Political Patrons in the U.S. and Abroad, and it's Robert Gleason, a well-published and well-thought-of author who has come to us today with this story. Bob, your assurance seems to be that sooner or later this is going to happen.
There's too much nuclear bomb fuel out there, too poorly secured. It's just been sitting there for too long, and eventually somebody's going to steal some. There was an Oak Ridge study in 78 that said if you have the equipment from an old dairy or an old winery, you can build a bomb fuel reprocessor. Now, you would have to have somebody there who knew how to do it. You'd have to help you. A Sandia weapons lab in the edge of San Francisco, which would be another irresistible target, they did a study of how hard would it be to build a small nuclear, low-tech nuclear reprocessor. And they said it would take 6 technicians to do it, that you would have to know something about how to do it. But also, these studies indicate that you could do this in a clandestine way. You could make it almost undetectable. And, you know, in particular, these bulk handling facilities like this Rokosho, they do so many tons of plutonium a year that, you know, to siphon off a little bit would be essentially undetectable. And anyway, it's been proven that the UN Atomic Energy Agency can't detect these things anyway.
Is there any way to put the genie back in the bottle?
Yeah, there is. Behind every nuclear proliferation, you know, potential nuclear terrorist problem around the world, there is always a nuclear power reactor at its core. And the thing, nuclear power is, it's stupid. If you wanted to give me an argument, if God came down and he said, you've got 3 hours to tell me why, and you got to do it because I'm God, and he said, you got to tell me why I should exterminate the human race, I could say it in 2 words, nuclear power. It is the dumbest thing we've ever done. You get a nuclear bomb fuel reprocessor, a nuclear power reactor is a nuclear bomb fuel factory, and they're dangerous. A former head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission once said they're so expensive. You know, the new estimates for building a nuclear power plant are $25 billion, both in the U.S. and the U.K., that you can get solar wind for a fraction of that.
Yeah, but Bob, don't we have presidents who have said nuclear has to be part of the energy problem?
President Obama says that all the time. And one of his biggest contributors starting out was Exelon. And I like Obama. I voted for him. But he refuses to tell the Japanese that this Rokosho plant is insane. He doesn't believe that we should be reprocessing nuclear waste because the process for doing it is the same for making nuclear bomb fuel. He doesn't say we should do it, but he's happy to have India do it. In fact, he's selling them nuclear power plants. He's happy to have the Japanese do it. He's upset that they don't secure it properly. You know, Hillary Clinton said when she was the Secretary of State, the rich Saudis, this is an exact quote, are the number one financiers of Sunni terrorism worldwide. That's an exact quote. That Sunni terrorism is, as you know, is Al-Qaeda Taliban-style terrorism. As you know, 15 out of 19 hijackers were Saudis. Those 28 pages that were blacked out on the Congressional 9/11 report, that it had to do, all 28 pages were about the involvement of wealthy Saudis with individual hijackers, including financing some of them. And it was so embarrassing that the Bush people cut it out. And Obama administration refuses to declassify. Well, nonetheless, who do you think is selling nuclear reactors to the Saudis right now as we speak? The Obama administration is helping to make the sale.
Do they have a bomb, you think?
Saudis
have a bomb?
Oh, I think that they basically own as many Pakistani bombs as they want. The thing is that there's this,
how does that work?
They bankrolled the whole Pakistani nuclear weapons program, and there was a deal cut. But furthermore, that Pakistan is completely dependent on the Saudis for their economic survival. And also, the Pakistani ambassador once said publicly, there's no difference between us and the Saudis, that we are the same country. That's a quote.
So how is, since you went to Japan in terms of this discussion, how is Fukushima and the devastation that it has caused, how has Fukushima affected the way the Japanese people think about nuclear weapons?
Well, the Japanese people obviously don't, you know, they don't like what happened to Fukushima. However, in Japan, And this, again, this is kind of inscrutable. We can't, something you and I don't think could understand. The people that run the nuclear power industry are viewed as gods, and the Japanese officials defer to them. They're almost, they're obsequious toward them. And that industry in Japan, our nuclear industry is very powerful. It's nothing compared to the power that the nuclear industry has in Japan.
Why is that? Because they're more dependent on it?
Well, I think, yeah, they made that decision some time ago to have that extreme dependence. However, also, the current defense minister in Japan, a former defense minister and former prime minister, said the reason we have so many of these plants is that we view nuclear power and we view the accumulation of all this plutonium, which we can't use, we have no earthly use for it, we view that as a de facto nuclear deterrent. And somebody once said, well, in fact, it's widely been quoted by experts, that Japan is never more than two screw turns and one wrench turn away from creating a nuclear weapon. It's just people assume that they've developed the weapon technology. They have the plutonium, but the weapons technology would be developed secretly. And it'd just be a matter of putting the two together. And they get weapons pretty quickly if they want. They, Lord knows they got the bomb fuel, and Lord knows they got as much technology as we have.
When you send this message to people, do people think, oh, you know, this guy's crazy, it's not really true?
There are some nuclear power hawks out there that really get absolutely incensed. I've gotten emails calling me a commie and a pinko and stuff like that.
But what is it about your message, which seems so real to me, what is it about your message that they say is wrong?
Oh, they'll challenge me on the science of it. I got an email from one of these guys, and he said I didn't know the difference between low-enriched and high-enriched uranium. So I went through it. I make the distinction 44 times in the book. In fact, I make the distinction be there's something called weapons grade, and then there's something called weapons usable. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have 90% to get a Nagasaki-type explosion. The book has been fact-checked very heavily over four different times by experts, and all the facts are correct. There is one thing. When I describe how to make one of these bombs, I deliberately slipped in some disinformation. I didn't want anybody using my book as a blueprint. None of these guys have ever called me out on that. But
isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But couldn't you be criticized for that, too, in terms of somebody attacking the book and saying, hey, this guy doesn't even know how to make a bomb?
Yeah, but if somebody made a bomb and set it off and then said, Bob Gleason taught me how to do it, that would ruin my life.
So I'm a little bit concerned about the inevitability issue that, you know, you seem to say, well, we could stop it, but we don't seem to have the will. It's proliferating all over the place. The Saudis, who are not always good people, have it. The Japanese have it. They don't know what to do with it. You got China sitting out there aiming stuff at Japan. You have, you know, the United States saying, we're going to stand behind Japan. Talk to me some more about the inevitability question.
Well, there's only one way to stop it, and that's to stop it at the source. Bomb-grade uranium, bomb-grade plutonium, it only gives off alpha rays. Alpha rays, alpha particles. Alpha particles can be stopped with skin. It can be stopped with that piece of paper there. As a result, you can smuggle it across borders, and the detectors won't pick it up. It's been said that if you really wanted to smuggle some in quantity, one way to do it would be to get a shipping container full of porcelain toilets and hide it in the toilet casing, and no detector in the world would ever pick it up. Now, if you mix it with oxides, you get nuclear waste. That's a holder that gives off gamma rays. If you stand near that for a minute, you'll die.
And but the bomb fuel is different. You started this sentence in this paragraph, I think, with there's only one way to stop it. But
I don't know the source. You've got to stop the nuclear reactors. As long as you have nuclear reactors, you're going to have nuclear bomb fuel. And you basically have to outlaw nuclear power. Everyone, whether it's Pakistan, Iran, that any of these countries...
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, you know that Aeschylus wrote in the Agamemnon 2,500 years ago that he was looking back on the 10-year war at Troy, the Trojan War, and it was out of folly and greed and stupidity, sex, all kinds of things. And then he's looking at the 28-year Peloponnesian War that he was living through, which was, again, stupid, and it destroyed the greatest democracy in the history of the world. And he wrote in the Agamemnon, we learn nothing save through suffering. The pain of memory falls drop by drop upon the heart in sleep. Against our will comes wisdom. The grace of the gods is forced on us. And Aeschylus believed that we learn nothing until the gods hammer us to pieces. I don't know. I hope to hell he's wrong, but I've never really seen a good reason to question that. Now, I believe there's always choices, and I believe all these problems are susceptible to solution. But Aeschylus may well be right. Maybe we got to go and have a half a dozen American cities nuked off the face of the earth before. But do you think we would learn anything from that? Did World War I teach us anything? It didn't teach Hitler. It didn't teach Stalin anything. Did World War II teach us anything? You know, we went straight into Korea and then Vietnam and Iraq. You know, if you go back and you look at American wars, all the way back to the Mexican War, except for one, World War II, where two nations declared war on us, except for World War II, we were all preemptive wars. We went into wars we didn't have to go into. You know, and World War I, World War II, you know, I'm not sure if we had a half a, and by the way, it'd be complete end of America as we know it, but I'm not sure if it had a half a dozen. My guess is if someone came in and they blew up Sandia and they nuked the New York Stock Exchange and went, my guess is we would probably eradicate a huge part of the world in the thermonuclear parking lots. That would be my guess how we'd respond.
Would that be the right thing to do for us? The only thing we could do? So in other words, George Bush said after 9/11, you know, said to Pakistan, apparently, you're either with us or against us. Would we be willing to inflict all of that collateral damage, all those people? We certainly were in Japan when we dropped the bomb.
Well, that's one scenario. I mean, that is only one scenario. The logic of it is somebody, the problem is there's been so much nuclear bomb fuel, so much nuclear explosive available for so long. You can make a Nagasaki-type bomb with 6.5 pounds of plutonium. And Japan cranking out has 40 tons, and they're cranking out 9 tons a year. They will be starting in October. I mean, there's so much of this stuff around that if somebody's able to build 6 bombs, why couldn't they build 12? And if they got 12, why couldn't they build 25? I mean, so the logic of it is, if you don't go and get rid of all your enemies at once, 6 more cities are going to be taken out. I got to tell you, one city is unbearable. Some things are just beyond bearing. So I'm giving you, that's one scenario. There's another scenario where you go and you say, look, we're going to incinerate the whole world, but you know, you're going to cough up the perpetrators. Otherwise, you're all going to vanish. And you give us all the perpetrators and we will work this out. That's another scenario. There's a lot of different kinds. Herman Kahn came up with hundreds of these scenarios in thinking about the unthinkable.
So let's go back to Obama. When he said, and we all heard him say it, I'm not that worried about what's going on, you know, in terms of one place in the world. I'm worried about somebody bombing New York. I assume he had some reason for saying that.
Yeah, because it's so frighteningly feasible. Also,
or does he have some information? I mean, if guys are willing to come in and run airplanes into the Twin Towers and do all of that and kill themselves, why wouldn't they be willing to do a nuclear thing?
Yeah, and a lot of the people that have examined this stuff have said that if terrorists came in and they actually detonated a nuke in front of the New York Stock Exchange, in some part, Pakistan would generate that attack. It's been called the ally from hell. And the Pakistanis are so paranoid about the United States and or India coming in. And they talk about this, doing an Osama bin Laden raid on their nuclear facilities. That's what they learned from, you know, when we killed bin Laden. They learned if they can get bin Laden like that, who was under their protection, they can do that to our nuclear facilities, too. They can grab all of our nuclear bombs or blow them up, whatever. They're scared to death of it. So one of the things they do is they have caravans, sometimes vans, actual vans, or trucks, and they always keep a number of their nuclear weapons in constant motion. They're in transit continually.
Well, so, we did that for years with our bombers, didn't we? Same thing?
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. But it's the terrorists over there that are blowing up nuclear facilities, but they aren't afraid of them. They're afraid of India and the United States coming in and getting the bombs. And I think, from our point of view, the more realistic threat to Pakistan is the terrorists somehow doing something so horrible it ends up in Islamist takeover of Pakistan or getting in and stealing a bunch of nukes. What would happen if Tariq-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, what would happen? And it's completely plausible. Suppose they hijacked one of these vans and they got away with a half a dozen nukes. Can you imagine the extortion? That
would be
a nightmare beyond belief.
And by the way, we're talking to Bob Gleason, and the book is The Nuclear Terrorist.
And my website is thenuclearterrorist.com. That's with a T.
Okay, and how come it hasn't happened yet?
Well, again, it's a question of scenario. I can give you one scenario is that for a conventional attack, like the bombing of the USS Cole or the bombing of those two American embassies in Africa, The Al-Qaeda took 5 years each to plan those. Now, suppose they went and they stole and hoarded enough nuclear explosive to take out a half a dozen American cities. That would be, from their point of view, the coup de grace.
Yeah,
that would
be,
well, how many, let me ask you, how many decades would they take to, if they take, you know, 5 years to plan a conventional bombing attack, how many decades would they take to plan that one?
Hey, Bob Gleason, I'm just listening to you, and you made a very compelling case about how easy it is to get this stuff. To get it, you told us how it could be done, how nuclear terrorists could do it. Now you say, well, the reason it hasn't happened, even though I told you how easy it is because people would have to take too long, you know, 5 years to get it done.
No, that's essentially how Al-Qaeda works. The other thing, too, is, okay, you're one of these Pakistani terrorist groups, and there's a very serious question. You go in and you start blowing stuff up in the United States. There's another scenario. Pakistani military might come after you full force, which they've never done before. They've been giving you money. They've been helping you out. They've been training you. They trained and created you to fight in Kashmir. Now suddenly they come after you all the way. That's another possible scenario. You know, but I don't accept the argument that they're just too stupid.
No, because I
can give you some of the attacks they've waged against Pakistan have been so sophisticated and so well planned. They would go in, they would have phony military uniforms. They would have doctored documents.
Sure.
They would have phony tags on their cars. They would go in, they would know where the surveillance cameras are. They would neutralize the surveillance cameras. They would kill scores of people in these attacks.
And yet they haven't done. Follow the scenario, Bob Gleason, that you laid out for us. I mean, how can you argue that a guy who has no feeling about having to stay alive, you know, who would run a plane into a building, won't inevitably do the same thing with a nuclear bomb?
Well, I would imagine that a person who did that would be part of a high... These terrorist groups are very sophisticated, extremely well organized. The discipline is incredible. And I don't think you're going to get a rogue terrorist from the TTP coming over here. They would come over as a group and they would do very serious damage. But I'll tell you one thing, Alan. History only teaches us one thing. And that's that the way things are today are not necessarily the way they're going to be tomorrow. And just because it hasn't happened previously, therefore you cannot argue that it will not happen tomorrow.
No. I'm not arguing any such thing. It's just that you paint this picture in your book, The Nuclear Terrorist, that makes it all seem so inevitable and so easy. And yet, when confronted with the reality that it hasn't happened, you haven't convinced me.
Well, I gave you some scenarios. I mean, I can't, you know.
Yeah.
Your argument, and you won't admit it, is your argument is that because it hasn't happened, therefore it can't happen.
No,
and
not,
that's not
no,
true.
Now you're putting, now you're putting words in my mouth.
That's called post hoc ergo proprio.
Yeah, no, I knew that because I used to argue with that Mario Cuomo, who would remind me of that all the time. No, but, you know, I don't have any question that it can happen. I have no question it can happen. I think the reason you're here, you're sitting here, is because I believe it. Now, we have a good deal of nuclear properties around us. We have one in the Hudson Valley. We have one, you know, in New England.
Mm-hmm.
If those blow up, if they really blow up, what would the damage be?
Well, there's been studies of Indian Point. If Indian Point had a serious meltdown, if somebody came in and they blew up the cooling pumps, and oh, yeah, if you can get into the control room and you know a little bit about what you're doing, it's just a matter of lifting the fuel rods out of the water and keeping them there for a few minutes. They'll catch fire, chain react. And if you blow up the cooling pumps, then all the spent fuel rods in the cooling pools, they're going to catch fire.
That's what happened to Fukushima. The
number of people that would have to be evacuated in that zone, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists and all that, is be a 50-mile zone, something like that. That's 20 million people. How do you evacuate 20 million people? You can't. No way to do it. And there have been studies that would say that eventually it would be at least a 500,000 fatalities, and the cost would be in the trillions of dollars. Now, suppose you did this to a half a dozen nuclear plants. Not that hard to do. You see, our nuclear power plants and our nuclear weapons labs that in Pakistan, they're actually protected by the army. They're pretty, these guys, the TTP that went in, these are some pretty smart, tough guys that did it. Ours are protected by septuagenarian rent-a-cops. They can go to the arsenal, check out a 9mm pistol, but that's the best they have. Furthermore, they're not trained to go up against 19 well-armed, well-trained 9/11-style hijackers. They're armed to go up against four or five guys, very lightly armed. They aren't trained. And by the way, in Japan, you know what the unarmed guards, you know what they're told in the case of a terrorist attack like that? Go home. Don't fight. That's their marching orders. There was a documentary.
Why is that?
The Japanese culture believes, and they make these statements publicly, they've made it to two administrations, that nobody would ever attack a Japanese nuclear installations because guns are illegal in Japan. Another argument they make is nobody would ever do that because we don't do those kinds of things. They say that there's 100% certainty. These are exact quotes. No terrorists would ever attack our facilities, nuclear facilities, because nobody dislikes us. We are not like you, United States. Nobody hates the Japanese. And by the way, that's essentially our position, too, because we make no attempts to defend these facilities against major attacks. We're just as stupid as the Japanese, aren't we?
I don't know. All I know is it hasn't happened yet. You are quite right. It's a very good chance that it's going to happen because, you know, you're going to get crazy people all over the place. I mean, does North Korea have a bomb?
Yeah, well, we had a chance. The Bush administration had a chance to stop that, too. They had the Clinton administration cut a deal with them where they had to keep all their spent fuel rods in a big box so they couldn't reprocess them into the nuclear bomb fuel.
The North Koreans.
North Koreans, yeah. And the Bush people were so obsessed with going into Iraq, I think, for the oil, that when the Japanese sent home the UN monitors and they turned off the surveillance cameras and they went and we had footage from satellites that were getting prepared to open the box and get the stuff out, that Clinton people said that we will bomb that box into radioactive dust. And that is the deal. Clinton called it the red line. And the Bush people let them, and they claimed, you know, we were going into Iraq because they didn't want the smoking gun of Saddam's nuclear program to be a mushroom cloud. Remember that? And we went in because they alleged that Saddam had, and Cheney actually said he had nuclear weapons. He said it on Meet the Press on March 16th, 2003. And we went in, and he didn't have any. And everybody knew it. Actually, the nuclear proliferation experts knew it. And we had a nation that was about to build, North Korea, about to build 9 nuclear weapons, and we could have stopped. The Bush people could have stopped it. And instead, they attacked a non-nuclear nation, obviously for the oil.
We are talking to Bob Gleason, Robert Gleason, the nuclear terrorist. And it's a compelling book, and if you don't want to sleep for a while, read it. So I want to go back to the Obama quote about how worried he is about somebody bringing a bomb in. Does he have reason based on, not philosophy, but based on hard facts to feel that way?
Yeah, but you know, I think that he's scared to death of Pakistan. I think everybody is. What's going on there is truly nightmarish. But on the other hand, as Hillary Clinton told him, while she was Secretary of State, the Saudis are the number one financiers of that style of terrorism, including in Pakistan. And he's trying to help sell nuclear reactors to the Saudis. You know, Alan, it seems to me that there's two universes in Washington. One is the universe of policy, trying to make intelligent decisions about how to protect this country. You know, and that's like, we got to worry about nuclear attacks. Then there's another universe, and it's called the universe of money. And in the universe of money, there's no such thing as dirty money. And if you can make a lot of money off the Saudis, well, you do that. You don't care where the money comes from. I think you know that George W. Bush's grandfather was a money manager for Hitler's number one financier during the 30s, Fritz Thyssen, who owned Thyssen Steel. He'd bankrolled Hitler since the Berhalt Putsch in 23. And that's the way of the world in Washington, D.C. Nobody challenges the big money. And I think then Obama's got that, like everybody else before him, he has this double think that, you know, that there's, yeah, we got to worry about, you know, Pakistani-inspired terrorists with access to nuclear technology and nuclear bomb fuel. We got to worry about that. But, you know, there's all this money to be made over here. And so then the two worlds never meet. They're two separate universes.
Bob Gleason, talk to us about Russia. We know that when the Soviet Union collapsed, there were a lot of bombs all over.
Yep.
What happened to them all, do we know?
A lot of the stuff, like the Ukrainian weapons that got repatriated back to Russia, and they did a fairly bad job of securing them. And they have gradually, over the years, they had spread them out in hundreds of different sites. And Graham Allison from the Kennedy School at Harvard co-authored a very good book on it called Avoiding Nuclear Anarchy. It was published by MIT Press. And he said one of the problems with the old Soviet Union was They really didn't have any accounting system. They didn't know where the stuff was. They didn't know how much there was. And he recommended that what the Clinton administration, he wrote the book in the 90s, that the Clinton administration, the first thing they should do would be send over an army of accountants and just go through everything, find out how much it was, where there was, you know, stuff. And he said you really had to do that before you secured it. Clinton did try to do some of this stuff, and the Republicans shot every effort.
And you think it's all about money?
Yeah, and they would argue that we're giving money to communists and all that. And also that the my own sense is the people that are real nuclear advocates, they don't want to admit that there's anything wrong with nuclear power. Mm-hmm. They don't want to admit that there's anything wrong with anything nuclear.
Let me go back to North Korea for a moment. There's a general feeling among many that this guy is, you know, their current dictator is a nut job and therefore wouldn't stop it using a nuclear weapon. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, sort of. I mean, I don't know what goes on in this guy's mind. He sounds to me like he's completely deranged. One of the interesting things about North Korea is during the Korean War, and this gets no coverage at all, we firebombed North Korea nonstop. Truman firebombed him just beyond belief, far worse than anything we did in Japan. Curtis LeMay later, who was the...
Sure.
Yeah, he said that we killed far more civilians in North Korea than we ever killed troops, including the Chinese troops. And my understanding is Kim Jong-il's father, he sent his family out of the country, but he was completely traumatized by that. And I think it's a trauma that they've never really gotten over. And I'm not sure that anybody wants... I think that if they set something off, it would be, you know, we'd turn North Korea into a thermonuclear parking lot. And I think they're pretty much aware of it. What kind of bothers me is, and you brought up Russia before, and I think Russia is much more aware of this.
And I also want to talk about China.
Yeah. You know, you think of a map of Iran.
Yeah.
What's on Iran's eastern border? Stone's throw over the, right over the border, Pakistan. They have a terrorist group over there. They hate the Shia far more than they hate us, because they've been hating them for 1,400 years.
Indeed, they have.
They got a group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, called the ISIL. And they make the al-Qaeda people that we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, they make them look like campfire girls. They are the evilest, most savage terrorist group ever. And it's partly because of their hatred for the Shia. And Iran's sitting there looking at Pakistan and thinking about, somehow they're able to blow up one of these caravans and the ISIL walks away with some nukes, and they decide they're going to finally fix
it. Do you think that the terrorists, a point you talk about in the book, but do you think they actually own these bombs already?
I think, you're talking about what scenario do you want to talk about. I think it's only prudent to assume. Let's talk about.
We know everywhere where every one of those Russian bombs are.
It's only prudent to assume that that some of these big terrorist groups managed to get their hands on some nuclear bomb fuel. It's not that hard to obtain. Why wouldn't they have some?
But do we know where every one of those guided missiles, every one of those things that we took back from other outliers and put back in Russia? Do we know where every one of them are?
Suppose somebody comes in and steals some. How would we know where it was?
Mm-hmm. You said prudent. Do you think it's prudent to think
prudent to assume that Iran, for instance, has some old Soviet bomb fuel. It would not be for them to steal it. It would not be a cold call. They have a very close nuclear relationship with Russia from their point of view and Russia's point of view, logical reasons. And for the Atomic Energy Ministry, for them to go in, find the location of some of these plants and walk out with some, it wouldn't be that difficult.
So are you the only one who's spitting in the wind on this stuff? I mean, you know, you're talking about it. You have a major book. It's well regarded. You've done your research. And yet, I dare say that most people don't know that it's there or what's happening.
Well, I work with a lot of military authors. I publish a lot of military fiction and nonfiction. A lot of these guys have, you know, been fairly high up in the Pentagon, a couple of former defense secretaries. And I ask these guys whatever, you know, every so often, because the way I got into it was I was working on a book about a big definitive novel about where nuclear terrorists parlay their strikes into a global nuclear Armageddon. It was called End of Days, a big book. And I was researching nuclear terrorism. I couldn't find anything on the subject. So I started asking my military authors if they could get me some unclassified Pentagon studies of nuclear terrorism. There aren't any. If one exists, it's buried so deep in some archive that nobody knows it exists. they couldn't find anything. And so I started looking, you know, trying to find some books. I couldn't find anything. I found Graham Allison's book, Avoiding Nuclear Anarchy, and later on he wrote a book called Nuclear Terrorism, but I couldn't find anything that talked about where they get the money, why we're not doing anything to stop it. And so, you know, it took me about, and I tried to commission that book. I couldn't get, and I know a lot of guys that could write it, and nobody would write it. And so I asked one of these guys, you know, come on, it's a national defense issue. Why doesn't the Pentagon study it? And the guy said, it's too scary. And I said, ah, come on. I said, this guy's a retired Army colonel who's worked in the Pentagon. He's a very highly regarded strategic thinker. And I said, that's crazy. You can't say that's too scary. And he said, yeah, really. He said that nuclear terrorism, he said, reduces military science to absurdity. He said, it makes a joke out of everything we study, a bad joke. And he said, and also you got to know something about science. And he said that a lot of people are science phobic in the military. And he said, they just won't go there. And also, you know, that one of the people that reviewed the book said I got into what he called, it was a nice turn of phrase, I wish I'd invented it. He called the no man's land between nuclear power and the nuclear bomb.
Mm.
And none of these thinkers about nuclear proliferation, none of them want to go there. You know, we complain about the nuclear programs in Iran and Pakistan. Who do you think sold them their first nuclear reactors?
Sure.
Us, the United States.
Talk to me about China.
China is scared to death right now, and this is a real problem of Japan's accelerated
plutonium
production.
Obviously, the Japanese have a green light from us on that.
The only thing we object to is that it's poorly secured. That's the only objection. We do not object to them producing all this plutonium. They have no earthly use for this Rokosho plant. Nobody said to them, pointed that out to them, just shut it down. One of the reasons, you know, why they're not shutting it down is to decommission it would cost $16 billion and take several decades. And the Japanese are too. It would be a loss of face. They worship at the altar of nuclear power, and they just won't go there. It's like the emperor wearing no clothes. And we won't say to him, the emperor's not only wearing no clothes, the emperor's going to cause a whole world of hurt. But China says their response to that is there is only one reason at all for Japan to be producing all this plutonium. They want to make a whole bunch of bombs. And China says it's only prudent to assume that there is no other explanation. So that's accelerating. It's encouraging China to produce more plutonium. We've been, since the 70s, South Korea has wanted to have a plutonium production program. We have fought them on that. How can we say no to South Korea now? India's built two plants that are going to be reprocessing over 100 tons each of spent fuel and creating plutonium on it. And by the way, we're selling them nuclear reactors knowing that they have these reprocessing programs. But for argument's sake, how could we say to India, don't do that, when we refuse to tell Japan not to do it?
Well, I've never understood, by the way, how we can tell anybody, to be perfectly frank with you, how we can tell anybody not to do it as long as we have it.
Yeah, and as long as we're selling them the reactors.
Well, we're selling them the reactors, but how do you say to Iran, for example, you are not allowed to the Ayatollahs and everybody else? I mean, look, I don't like these people, but what's the argument? You can't have it. We have it. We're here first.
Yeah, and Japan can make scores of tons of plutonium, but you can't create any. You know, they've got Pakistan on their eastern border, and just above Pakistan, they have Afghanistan. They live in a very dangerous neighborhood. But, you know, they can't defend themselves, but Japan can make all the stuff. That's what Alan said before, that basically the nations of the world, after they got together, outlaw nuclear power, and then nobody can make any of this stuff.
I heard a guy on the radio the other day who was making the argument that the world couldn't survive with, and I've heard this before, by the way, with its present system of nation states. And we had to cut out nation states immediately if we were to survive. And, you know, I always say, okay, you know, open your legs and kiss your behind goodbye, mm-hmm. because we're not going to end nation states.
No.
Well, you know, I hate to say this to you, Bob Gleason, but you sound a little like that. And the only way out of this is to basically do away with these nuclear plants.
Yeah, you got to get rid of the nuclear reactors. Once you get a nuclear reactor, it's too easy to make the nuclear bomb.
I agree with you.
If
I had a magic wand and I could go, poof, they're gone, they'd be gone. Believe me, they would. Yeah. But how do you achieve that?
Well, yeah, it's utopian, but if you don't achieve it, you know, what are the consequences? And it maybe Aeschylus was right 2,500 years ago. Maybe Maybe after a bunch of cities get nuked, maybe people will wake up. I kind of doubt it, but, you know, yeah, maybe. But, you know, sometimes, yeah, I'm in the book publishing business. There was a woman named Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring. And she created, a lot of people claim she created the environmental movement worldwide. There was no environmental movement. Sometimes you get a book that's a shot heard around the world, a documentary. Sometimes people, do they have a great awakening? You know, the consciousness is raised, you know, and we hope. And, you know, a lot of New Age people talk about we're entering some new transcendental thing. I don't believe that.
Well, you know, Pete Seeger was in the Clamshell Alliance, and they would go out and they would surround nuclear plants, and they would
say, he was a great man.
Yes, he was, and go away. But, I'm concerned that if there's anything wrong with your work, it's that you don't really give us a plan for how to do what you say must be done.
Yeah, actually, I do have in the book, I have a fairly detailed plan.
Well, and the detailed plan is?
Bernie Sanders laid out, and he had a bill on what you do about nuclear power. One of the things is nuclear power is not private industry. It's pure socialism. Forbes once wrote that Ronald Reagan claimed to be a laissez-faire capitalist was not when it came to nuclear power, because he'd worked, as you know, for GE for 9 years. And and he said, you stop the federal subsidies to nuclear power. You make them function on their own. No insurance company will insure a nuclear power plant, not give it full coverage. You make them go out, buy their own insurance. You stop all these subsidies. You make them pay for that. You make them come up with a plan for disposing. And
what gives you the will, Bob Gleason, to do that?
Well, we claim we believe in capitalism. Well, Ronald Reagan made a deal with the nuclear power industry where he would create something called a Yucca Mountain repository. And if it wasn't ready to start receiving nuclear waste by the mid-late 1990s, that we would pay the nuclear industry billions of dollars a year, which we are, by the way, we're doing. There's lawsuits over whether that we've been resisting paying them, but that's the law. Why are we doing it? Why do we owe them billing? Why do we have to build a repository? You know, but we allegedly believe in free market capitalism. Make them live by the basic principles of free market capitalism. That's the sense of, and I think most Americans would understand that. You know, they're always talking about, you know, about cutting government spending, you know, cutting taxes. Well, you know, cut all the subsidies to the nuclear power industry. That ought to be good Tea Party thinking, shouldn't it? I think the Tea Party would understand that. They don't want government handouts.
No, I don't think they'd understand
it. They're probably not.
And so I wonder what it is that would light the fire. You know, every time I go over the bridge to New York City, and I go quite frequently, I think of what Obama said. He wants to prevent this from happening, somebody bringing a bomb into New York. I get the feeling that it could happen. I have no difference with you on that. But what I am worried about is what it does to our national psyche that so many of us have to start thinking that way.
Well, what did it do to Japan? They have come, ironically, to worship at the altar of nuclear power. You know, this Rakosho plant that they're building, there is no nation on earth that has a plant like that that does not have a nuclear weapons program. And their prime ministers, defense ministers have said, we have all these mountains of plutonium because it's a de facto nuclear deterrent. And they have believed that they have to be a nuclear state. That's what Hiroshima, that's the lesson they took away from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They believe that these nuclear power executives are national heroes. You know, obviously the nuclear power and industry in this country can do virtually anything they want, including get stupendous subsidies from taxpayers. But we don't worship them the way the Japanese do.
I only have 2 minutes, but the Chinese, are you satisfied with their security system?
Nobody really knows much about their security system. They don't let anybody in there. But what I am concerned about is that the Japanese have incited kind of a plutonium race in the Pacific and those Eastern Asian countries. South Korea wants to get into it. Taiwan wants to get into it. India and China are producing more and more of the stuff. And you're getting to Iran because the Sunni nations. Ironically, nobody's afraid of the Israeli nuclear program. Nobody's afraid of the American nukes. The Sunni nations are scared to death that Iran will get a nuclear weapon. Iran is scared to death of the nukes on their neighboring nation, Pakistan. And I don't know how you stop Iran from getting one. And by the way, the Russians are also scared to death of the Sunni terrorists, the Chechnyan Al-Qaeda. A lot of, we were talking about that some of these big terror, horrible terrorist groups, including that ISIL, that some of the top people are Chechnyans. And the Russians have never been afraid of the Shia. And also, I got to tell you, when you look at it, we're talking about that ISIL and how unbelievably savage they are. The Shia don't have comparable terrorist groups. They don't have anybody like, there's no terrorist groups in Iran that are blowing up Iranian nuclear sites like you have in Pakistan. They don't have, you know, there aren't any terrorists in Iran that are flattening the World Trade Centers. And they are really scared to death. They are as scared to death of these Taliban Al-Qaeda style terrorists as we are. Mm-hmm. And that and the Russians are too. But, you know, but our alliances are with the countries that sponsor those kinds of terrorists.
Our guest is Robert Gleason, and his book is The Nuclear Terrorist, His Financial Backers and Political Patrons in the U.S. and Abroad. Robert, why don't you give us your website so that people can check in with you?
Oh, thank you. It's www.thenuclearterrorist.com. That's terrorist with a T. And also, you can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter.
Robert Gleason, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Been a pleasure, although I must say, maybe I won't sleep so well tonight.
Thank you so much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.